Book of Daniel, chapter 5, verses 1 to 7 and 17 to 31. King Belshazzar gave a great banquet for 1,000 of his nobles and drank wine with them. While Belshazzar was drinking his wine, he gave orders to bring in the gold and silver goblets that Nebuchadnezzar, his father, had taken from the temple in Jerusalem, so that the king and his nobles, his wives and his concubines might drink from them. So they brought in the gold goblets that had been taken from the temple of God in Jerusalem, and the king and his nobles, his wives and his concubines, drank from them. As they drank the wine, they praised the gods of gold and silver, of bronze, iron, wood, and stone. Suddenly, the fingers of a human hand appeared and wrote on the plaster of the wall near the lampstand in the royal palace. The king watched the hand as it wrote. His face turned pale, and he was so frightened that his legs became weak and his knees were knocking. The king summoned the enchanters, astrologers, and diviners. Then he said to these wise men of Babylon, "Whoever reads this writing and tells me what it means will be clothed in purple and have a gold chain placed around his neck, and he will be made the third highest ruler in the kingdom." Then Daniel answered the king, "You may keep your gifts for yourself and give your rewards to someone else. Nevertheless, I will read the writing for the king and tell him what it means. Your Majesty, the Most High God gave your father Nebuchadnezzar sovereignty and greatness and glory and splendor. Because of the high position he gave him, all the nations and peoples of every language dreaded and feared him. Those the king wanted to put to death, he put to death. Those he wanted to spare, he spared. Those he wanted to promote, he promoted. And those he wanted to humble, he humbled. But when his heart became arrogant and hardened with pride, he was deposed from his royal throne and stripped of his glory. He was driven away from people and given the mind of an animal. He lived with the wild donkeys and ate grass like the ox, and his body was drenched with the dew of heaven until he acknowledged that the Most High God is sovereign over all kingdoms on earth and sets over them anyone he wishes. But you, Belshazzar, his son, have not humbled yourself, though you knew all this. Instead, you have set yourself up against the Lord of heaven. You had the goblets from his temple brought to you, and you and your nobles, your wives and your concubines, drank wine from them. You praised the gods of silver and gold, of bronze, iron, wood and stone, which cannot see or hear or understand. But you did not honor the God who holds in his hand your life and all your ways. Therefore, he sent the hand that wrote the inscription. This is the inscription that was written: Mene, Mene, Tekel, Parsin. Here is what these words mean. Mene, God has numbered the days of your reign and brought it to an end. Tekel, you have been weighed on the scales and found wanting. Peres, your kingdom is divided and given to the Medes and Persians. Then, at Belshazzar's command, Daniel was clothed in purple, a gold chain was placed around his neck, and he was proclaimed the third highest ruler in the kingdom. That very night, Belshazzar, king of the Babylonians, was slain, and Darius the Mede took over the kingdom at the age of 62. This is the word of the Lord. Thanks be to God.
Thank you, Derek, and good morning, ladies and gentlemen. It's lovely to be here with you. I enjoy preaching at the 11:30. You can always have a good chuckle with the 11:30 congregation. I'll begin by telling you, I famously discovered when I was youth director, one of the boys in the youth group writing on the walls in our old youth work Kaifong Center over here, and he turned around and he said to me, "Well, if God didn't want us to graffiti, he shouldn't have given us a biblical example of it in the book of Daniel." very cleverly. Now, this morning's sermon is not a biblical theology of vandalism. I'm going to go beyond that, I promise you. I'm aware that not all graffiti is clever or interesting or amusing, but I do recognize that some of it is actually very profound and it can move us. In 2017, in London and Shoreditch, the UK public voted the graffiti artist Banksy's piece, "The Girl with a Balloon," as their favourite piece. In Hong Kong, if you're familiar with Soho on Graham Street, Hong Kongers are literally taking their lives into their own hands by trying to get this perfect Instagram shot on Graham Street, right next to the GOD store. They will meet GOD, I believe, if they're not careful. And my own personal piece of graffiti, which is from a gentleman's toilets in Northern Ireland, I don't have a photo for obvious reasons, it just said this: "Socrates, to do is to be. Sartre, to be is to do. Sinatra, dooby dooby do." And graffiti does have significance. It can move us. And our graffiti today is significant, not just because it's the story of it has entered into common parlance in the English language. You may have heard the phrase, "Your days are numbered. You've been measured and found, weighed and found wanting, and the writing is on the wall." All everyday expressions. But our story today has far further reaching implications, both for King Belshazzar in our story and indeed for us today. Life-changing message for our time. For I believe Daniel 5 is a message that is so true, a message that is so real, that it smashes all other illusions and delusions and misconceptions. It gives our king today a window into another world, a window which perhaps if we're brave enough to look through it, we see the real world perhaps for the very first time, a world that makes us realize that our own reality is perhaps not quite as real as it seems. For in our reality in the world of today, what it tells us is that not so much that God doesn't exist, but that God doesn't really matter. Follow God in your own home, keep it private in your church, that's fine, just don't dare bring it into work. In business, it's the targets, it's the bottom line, that's what really matters. At home, God doesn't seem to be so important these days, it's the children's education and discipline, that's what really matters today. But our story, it shows us how reality and fantasy, they collide. And the script, well, it doesn't go according to plan. Belshazzar, he gets a real word from God and his own reality is left smashed and in tatters. And the message from Daniel 5 is clear and calm. There is a God, the one true God of heaven, and he is in control and he is coming back to end all of those who have stood against him. And it speaks to individuals, to states, to nations, to the academy, to ideologies. Defy him at your peril, for if you do, your days will be numbered. And we would do very well this morning to hear this word from the real world. So I'm going to frame, it's a fantastic story. We just want to get stuck in. 1, 2, and 3. Firstly, a party to die for. Secondly, we're going to examine a sobering thought and finally conclude with a real world word. Belshazzar is our antagonist today, and I suppose no one really wants to be in charge at the downfall of an empire, especially when it's the greatest empire known to man, but that's the context where we are today. Belshazzar is technically not the king. We believe it was his father, Nabonidus, but he's often off doing other things or fighting other wars. So he's just temporarily in charge. And we get a clue for that in the fact that Daniel is only offered the third highest position in the land for his reward. The background here is that, well, Babylon's not having a good time of it. The armies of Cyrus and Darius, they've defeated the armies of Babylon 50 miles outside the gates approximately 10 days before our events take place in chapter 5. And now the enemies of Babylon, well, they are at the gates and they are knocking. And our young king, our young master, well, it seems like he is living in a world of fantasy. The design of Daniel should also be noted. It's absolutely masterful. It should not go unnoted that right at the center of Daniel, he includes as his central point the fall of Babylon, which has stood against God for so long. It's also not insignificant in contrast, and I believe that chapter 4 and 5 should be read together. But the very last verse of chapter 4 about Nebuchadnezzar. Now I, Nebuchadnezzar, praise and exalt and glorify the King of Heaven because everything he does is right and all his ways are just. And those who walk in pride, he is able to humble. They acknowledge of Belshazzar's forefather, Nebuchadnezzar, acknowledging God and his humility and his restoration. And what does our young king do when the enemies are outside at the gate? Well, he had a great banquet for 1,000 of his nobles and drank wine with them. Certainly, it sounds like a party to die for. Five times in the first four verses, we're told they're continually drinking wine. It certainly sounds like a boozy party. Shiraz was actually the local grape, the regional grape for Babylon, but I'm sure it wasn't the cheap stuff from a box. And we don't get much mention of the food. We don't know what they were eating, but we're told it's 1,000 of the good and the great in the land, but also that their wives and concubines were present as well, suggesting that this is perhaps slightly more rambunctious affair than your average state banquet at Buckingham Palace. But the grandeur is clear, and our king, it seems, is living in total fantasy. And our young king, an insecure king, well, he does what a lot of insecure men do when they drink too much. They either wilt or they start making brash and bold claims. Perhaps he's got a little bit of Dutch courage from all the wine that he has drunk this evening. And he makes a demand in chapter 2. He gave orders to bring in the gold and silver goblets that Nebuchadnezzar, his father, had taken from the temple in Jerusalem so that the king and his nobles might drink from them. These were not just any old cups they dragged in from the pantry. No, these were the cups from God's holy temple in Jerusalem. Cups that had been set apart and ordained and sanctified to be used in religious ritual and practice. A hope for the Jewish people that these cups celebrated and pointed towards the future final banquet, the wedding feast, when the Messianic age would be ushered in. And shockingly, he brings these cups into the banquet. And he doesn't just drink from them, but as we're told in verse 4, as they drank from them, he started to make toasts to the gods of gold and silver and wood and bronze and stone, created things. And this is the theological equivalent of giving the one true God in heaven the middle finger. It would be as offensive to us today as me taking our special cups that we use for communion and using them to toast a plethora of other religions. And just imagine it for a moment. You're a guest at this party. You're the old guard. You remember what happened in chapter 4 to King Nebuchadnezzar. His humbling, his pride, his falling, his restoration, his acknowledgement of the God of heaven. Your eyes would turn now to this new young king and you'd think, oh, the apple has fallen far from the tree. For Belshazzar, it seems, it's not God who is at the center of his universe, but himself and his own ego. And he's acting out in total fantasy. But now, he gets, as our story goes on, he gets a sobering thought, a remarkable incident as our rambunctious rugby dinner, it turns into the scene of a horror movie as suddenly in verse 5, the fingers of a human hand appeared and wrote on the plaster off the wall near the lampstand in the royal palace. The king sees this, we're not sure who else, but I love the king's response. I love the emotions that are described for him. His face turned pale. He became so frightened. His legs became weak and his knees were knocking. Such was the terror. I actually believe this is a very gracious translation. The Aramaic for his legs became weak could also be translated into his bowels became weak. This imagery of the king in terror as he runs for the bathroom. An absolutely frightening scene. But he's alarmed, he's frightened, and he does what Babylonian kings seem to have done in the rest of Daniel. When they need something interpreted, they drag in the Ministry of Magic, the Department for Magical Affairs, the diviners, the interpreters, the magicians. I really don't know why these guys are still around. In chapter 2 and 4, they've been absolutely useless. Someone should have said, just go straight to Daniel. But in verse 7, they're brought in, and to no avail. They don't know what it means, and the king's horror is only heightened. And Rembrandt, he captures the terror in Belshazzar very well in his epic painting, Belshazzar's Feast, the terror of the hand, writing on the wall. And not printed or read this morning, but equally important to the story, is the queen hears all this commotion, and she totters in. Now, it's of note, she's not at the feast, which might suggest she's another king's wife or Nebuchadnezzar's wife, or in fact, the king mother. But she totters in, and she's old enough to remember all that had happened in the past. She, an echo from the past, if you will. She begins in verse 11, talking about a man called Daniel, and she tells this all to our new young king. There's a man in your kingdom who has the spirit of the holy gods in him. In the time of your father, he was found to have insight and intelligence and wisdom like that of the gods. Your father, King Nebuchadnezzar, appointed him chief of the magicians, enchanters, astrologers, and diviners. The king gets a little history lesson. Now, I imagine our new king is not so pleased when he hears this detailed history about this great guy, Daniel, and what Nebuchadnezzar did. For he's the new kid on the block. He's trying to put his stamp down. To hear about the past, well, that's simply yesterday's world, and yesterday's world belongs to yesterday's men. Well, he listens to the queen, and he Daniel's pulled in, or perhaps wheeled in, perhaps. Often we tend to read the biblical narratives and see these heroes of the faith and think they're rampaging around the Middle East with great gusto and courage and high faith and adventure. I can tell you that Daniel has been in Babylon now approximately 65 years. And in his book, there's only four startling instances that he is called upon. For Daniel's life, no, it seems that his life is marked not so much by miracles, but a quiet, constant, faithful march in the right direction. That's the mark of Daniel and his friends living in a hostile world. A slow march in the right direction. He's dragged in. He's in front of Belshazzar. There he is. And the king in verse 13, he has no recollection of Daniel, no record of his titles, no record of his achievements, no recollection of his faith. Look at what he says. Are you Daniel, one of the exiles my father, the king, brought from Judah? Who are you? That's what the king is saying. For Belshazzar, in his mind, Daniel, well, he's been pensioned off. He's been grandfathered to floor 37 of the Babylonian Ministry of Magic, where his job's to sharpen wands and pencils. The king says, I've heard this and that about you, but so what? But with all the charm of a used car salesman, he turns to Daniel and say, but if you can interpret this writing on the wall, I'll make you the third highest ruler in the land. You'll get a purple robe and a great big chain. So will you be a good lad and do it anyway for me? And I must say, I admire Daniel in verse 17 for his response. Do you see what he says to the king at this promise of great wealth? You can keep your gifts for yourself and give your rewards to someone else. He's saying you can keep it all. You can't buy this wisdom. You can't buy God. And you certainly can't buy the person of God. No, you couldn't afford it. He says, then, I'll tell you what it means. Humorously, he doesn't tell the king what it means. He gives them another more detailed and in-depth history lesson about his forefather, King Nebuchadnezzar, about how Nebuchadnezzar became arrogant and hardened with pride. He was deposed from his royal throne and stripped of his glory. He reminds the king until Nebuchadnezzar acknowledged that the most high God is sovereign over all kingdoms on earth and sets over them anyone he wishes. How Nebuchadnezzar ate like a beast, was restored. A sobering word indeed. But now we come to a real world word. And the punchline hits in verse 22 and 23, except no one is laughing. Do you see what Daniel says to him? You, Belshazzar, his son, you haven't humbled yourself, though you knew all of this. Though you knew all of this and those dreadful words in 23, you have set yourself up against the Lord of heaven. You knew the truth. You knew the history. You knew the faith. And you've done all of this anyway. You think you're living in the real world, son. No, no, no. You are living in a world of fantasy. When a king goes mad and acts and lives with the cows and eats the grass and is restored and extols the God of heaven afterwards, you don't need the paparazzi or the Apple Daily to tell you what is going on. Everyone in the whole empire would have known exactly what King Nebuchadnezzar had gone through. He's saying, you knew. And you did all of this anyway. And you could think, well, how did Belshazzar get here? Perhaps this was just a one-off. He was having a bad day. He'd fallen out with his wife. That's why she wasn't at the feast. Or perhaps he was just drunk. Could we just give him a break? Well, no, it seems clear for Belshazzar. Calvin describes him as a man of no consequence. And contrary to Daniel, who has been doing a slow march in the right direction, Belshazzar seems to be doing a slow march in the wrong direction. Every day we make choices that turn us further into a child of God or into his enemy. C.S. Lewis puts it very eloquently when he says, all your life long, you are slowly turning this central thing, that's the self, into a heavenly creature or a hellish creature. Either into a creature that is in harmony with God and with other creatures and with itself, or else into one that is in a state of war and hatred with God. Contrary to Daniel, Belshazzar, it's a wrong march in the wrong direction with the wrong people making the wrong decisions. Living in fantasy, it is no surprise he has ended up here. But I think if we're honest, I think if we did search our hearts just for a moment, we know that there's traits in Belshazzar that are in each and every one of us. We're so quick to ignore or dismiss the truth of our faith. We're so speedy to write it off as the faith of granny. And I'm a 21st century person. I don't need those things from the old days, just like Belshazzar. We come to church, we explore the evidence, we attend a CE course. We come along to our Bible study, but we just go through the motions and muck around. We hear the sermon and we take notes, only to file them and to be forgotten. Daniel would say to us, you knew all of this. You knew all of this. And the warning from Belshazzar should be absolutely clear. And tragedy for him is that the time has run out. The day has come and it is too late. Can you imagine that sick feeling you get deep in your stomach when you know you're late for an important appointment or something like that? I certainly know acutely from a man who's missed 8 flights in his lifetime. That sick, sinking feeling when you know that the game is up and you have missed out. And for Belshazzar, note, look at the text. His life is reduced to one evening. But note, there is no protest. There is no appeal. There is no comeback. There is no defense. There's no second hearing. Because he's heard a real word from the real world. A word that is so true. A word that is so real. That no one can say anything at all. That's the real word that he gets from Daniel. And then Daniel, well, the writing seems to be already on the wall. but he goes on to translate it anyway. Three words, many, many, tekel, peres. Three common coins. And Daniel tells them what their significance means. Many, God has numbered the days of your reign and brought it to an end. Your number's up, king. The game is over. Your days are numbered. And well, for Belshazzar, it ended that night. Tekel, the word for to be weighed. You've been weighed on the scales and found wanting. You've come up short. You don't make the quota. You don't make the cut. And finally, Perez, your kingdom is divided and it will be given to the Medes and the Persian. The greatest empire on earth is going to be ripped apart. A terrifying pronouncement on any human being. And well, that very night it came true. Darius the Mede came through the walls and took over Babylon. And we're told he did it at the age of 62 to give us some encouragement sailing into retirement. The biggest regime change that the world had ever seen, done and dusted in a night. And you see, for Belshazzar, he'd stepped over a line. Judgment had been met. A line where God's patience had finally run out. And what he learned finally was that in the real world, God matters. He will not let defiance to his name go on forever. From the king to the pauper, to the superpower state, to a government, to a regime, to an academy, to an ideology. He says, set yourself up against him at your peril, but you will be measured. You will be found wanting. You will be divided. The writing is on the wall. God might let your enterprise or your state or your perspective carry on for a season. You might even do very well, but be under no illusions. It will come to an end, for judgment belongs to the Lord. Paul sums it up very well in the book of Acts, this sentiment, chapter 17. He says, for he has set a day when he will judge the world with justice by the man he has appointed. He has given proof of this to everyone by raising him from the dead. You can hear that and perhaps sits uneasy with a lot of us. We can dismiss it as old-fashioned. It's what Granny used to think. It's very Old Testament, and I'm a New Testament kind of person. I'm all peace and love. But just remember that Jesus told a story that almost paralleled the downfall of Belshazzar. In Luke chapter 12, a farmer who was so full of it and needed to build bigger barns, he didn't acknowledge God. And he said, take life easy. Eat, drink, and be merry. But God said to him, you fool, this very night your life will be demanded from you. Then who will get what you have prepared for yourself? I think striking similarities with our story with Belshazzar. These stories can frighten us, but the Christian today can and should take great hope from these stories, this story. For this story gives us hope that there is a one true God, that this one true God is in control, he is sovereign, and he is for his people. And he is coming back to end all of the wrong and the hurt and the shame in the world. And while you might not feel it is good news today sitting in the pew, I tell you, if you are a Christian suffering in Sri Lanka or in the Middle East, if you are a Christian riddled with cancer or disease or social decay in your family, Jesus coming back is the best news that you can ever hear, for it tells us that God is for us. And it's when we come face to face with God, when we read his word and we hear these words and his pronouncements and his character and his control, that's the window into the real world that doesn't so much break into our reality, but God somewhat brings us into his. When I was a young undergraduate student, Carl Barth helped me to balance this idea in a very positive way. He wrote a wonderful essay called The Strange New World Within the Bible. He told a famous illustration by now about a group of people who lived in a huge warehouse. And the warehouse had no entrances or exits. It only had windows. And the windows were so dirty and grimy and dusty that people couldn't see out, and they never bothered. Well, why would you? Until one day, a little girl, she dragged a stool over to the window and climbed on the sill. With her hands, she wiped away the years and years of grime and decay. And to her amazement, she saw blue. And she saw people, and she saw trees and dogs and people laughing and enjoying themselves. And she called her friends, and they were amazed until they started to get frustrated, because the people every so often would stop, and they would, people outside, and they would look up and point to the sky with smiles and joy and amazement. And they couldn't understand what they were looking at, because they could only see the dark roof of the warehouse. If only they had known that the people were amazed by a beautiful cloud or a flock of geese or some sort of aircraft. And if only that day they decided to cut an entrance in the side of the warehouse, they would have gone out into this bright new world that went before them, a world that the warehouse could never have prepared them for, the life and the beauty and the creation that it held. And what Bart says is that when you read the Bible, when you come face to face with God, you come into this strange new world that the warehouse could never have prepared you for, that this world could never prepare you for. A world of creation and salvation and life and hope that stretches above and below and beyond forever and ever and ever. A wonderful story, a wonderful hope. That's what Belshazzar needed to hear long before his number was up. And as I finish, a little bit later, we're going to come to another sermon of sorts, another story about God's grace, a story about another cup, a cup of God's judgment that was poured onto his son, Jesus Christ, a story that tells us that one day we will be measured, we will be weighed. But the story of this cup tells us a story that will be weighed and will be found perfect, because God will look at us and he will see his son. A story that tells us without him, our days are numbered. But with Christ, the numbers will never run out, for we are united to him. So I invite you to come and respond to this message this morning. Come and drink the cup, but don't drink the cup until you face the writing. Don't drink the cup until you face the writing. Come out of the warehouse and see the real world that God invites us to join him in, and perhaps see it and experience for the very first time. It's more real and beautiful than you ever imagined. Amen. Let me close in prayer, and then we'll respond with the band. Father, thank you for these remarkable stories that speak of your sovereignty, your power, your future coming to end all evil, but stories, Lord, that do trouble us. Please help us to reconcile it, Lord, with your Son, that you are for us, you are good for us, Lord, and you have secured victory for us in Christ. Please help those of us today who are struggling in our Christian faith, struggling with suffering, with persecution, with illness, or family difficulties, Lord. I pray that your grace would be enough. You would meet us in your Son and give us great hope to look to the future and your second coming in Jesus. Amen. Thank you. Please take a moment of silence.